in the season's final two games and lost both. As Keenum stood on the sidelines watching Rodgers come off in obvious pain, his emotions weren't mixed in the least. He was upset. "I've been through a serious injury, so I know how awful it feels, especially when you come off and you're almost certain the injury is serious," he said. "Aaron Rodgers is good for the NFL. He's a true star. You want to compete against him, and you want to try to beat him. My heart just went out to the guy. You don't want to see anyone hurt, but we all know injuries, sometimes serious ones, are part of football. Quarterbacks take a beating, even when they aren't injured. You know when someone like Aaron goes down, it changes the entire season for a team," which is exactly what happened to the Packers. Keenum and the Vikings beat the Packers that day, and when the extent of Rodgers' injury was learned, millions of hearts within Packer Nation fell. There are only a handful of quarterbacks in the NFL who are that vital to a team's hopes. Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Cam Newton, Russell Wilson, Andrew Luck, and Ben Roethlisberger. There are also a handful of quarterbacks not on that level whose loss to injury would ruin a team's season. Flacco, Philip Rivers, Dak Prescott, Eli Manning, and, as of last season, Carson Wentz and Jared Goff. A team might be able to survive without them for a game or two, but not long term. As remarkable as Foles' performance was in the 2018 playoffs, it isn't likely that the Eagles would have been the Eagles if Wentz had gone down when Rodgers did. Then again, Foles might be the exception that proves the rule, someone who had been a Pro Bowler in the past. When Luck was unable to play for the entire 2017 season, the Colts had to give up a second-round pick to the Patriots to acquire Jacoby Brissett just to have a respectable quarterback, and they completely tanked, going 4-12. There are plenty of other examples. Even though Kirk Cousins played admirably once he was given the job in Washington following Robert Griffin III's injuries, the entire arc of the franchise changed. The team went from having a potential Hall of Famer at quarterback to a solid quarterback the owner and team president never really wanted as their starter. Keenum, bolstered by a superb defense, had a remarkable season in 2017. The Vikings won 10 of their last 11 regular season games and were the number 2 seed in the NFC, behind Philadelphia, in the playoffs. Even though Keenum played very well in Bradford's stead, there were still those in Minneapolis who hoped Bradford would come back after the team's bye week to take his job back. He didn't. By the time he was ready to play in the postseason, Keenum had played so well there was no thought at all of benching him. Keenum and Foles were exceptions. More often than not, when a team loses a starter, the effects are catastrophic. When Flacco clearly wasn't ready to play in the exhibition opener, the Ravens began looking for another quarterback. They didn't want Ryan Mallett, Flacco's backup, to play too much because they needed him healthy if Flacco wasn't ready to play in the opener in Cincinnati. The only other quarterback on the roster was Dustin Vaughn, who had never taken a snap in a regular season game. That's where Kaepernick came in, potentially. The fact that he had not been signed since opting out in March had become a polarizing topic. The quality of some of the backups being signed was well below Kaepernick's career resume, including the 2016 season. When Flacco's injury was announced, there were questions right away about the possibility of signing Kaepernick. Coach John Harbaugh had nothing but good things to say about him as a quarterback and as a person. Kaepernick came to Baltimore to meet with team officials. But when the dust cleared, the Ravens signed someone named David Olsen, whose most recent team had been the Kansas City Phantoms of the Champions Indoor Football League, a second-tier arena football league. Olsen's career in Baltimore lasted 4 days. He was cut on July 31st, and the Ravens signed Josh Woodruff, who had also never taken an NFL snap and had most recently been released by the Bills in May. The Ravens' given reason for not signing Kaepernick was that they hadn't felt he was still passionate about playing football when they'd met with him. There had been a report that owner Steve Bisciotti didn't want to sign him because he was afraid of fan backlash. General Manager Ozzie Newsome issued a non-denial denial of that story, saying in a statement that Bisciotti had never told him he couldn't sign Kaepernick. A month later, just prior to the start of the season, Ray Lewis, the Ravens' iconic former linebacker, went on the NFL Network and said he had pushed the team to sign Kaepernick, but the battle had been lost when Kaepernick's girlfriend, Nessa Diab, posted a tweet that was perceived as racist. The tweet showed a photo of Lewis with his arm wrapped around Bisciotti, and a second photo from a movie called Django Unchained, which showed an almost identical photo of Samuel L. Jackson playing a slave with his arm around a dying Leonardo DiCaprio, his owner. Clearly, Diab was making a point about the relationships between NFL players and owners. Whether it was racist was open to interpretation, but it apparently gave the Ravens another reason not to sign Kaepernick, even though he was clearly a better and far more experienced quarterback than David Olsen or Josh Woodruff, or, for that matter, Ryan Mallett. Flacco, working to be ready for the season, was bemused by the whole thing. If I hadn't been able to start the season, I would think he'd be someone who would be pretty good insurance behind Ryan, he said. I don't think anyone in the locker room would have had a problem with him being signed. For the most part, guys just want to know if you can help the team. Several Ravens, notably Terrell Suggs, the leader of the defense, had emphatically made that point. But the Ravens didn't sign Kaepernick. Neither did anyone else. Clearly, in spite of the excuse-making going on, each of the 32 teams had decided they weren't going to sign Kaepernick. As the season went on, the excuse-making grew louder, with anonymous front office executives insisting that Kaepernick wasn't that good a player anymore or that he wasn't, quote, worth the trouble, as in booing fans. No doubt if Kaepernick had been signed and played well, the boos would have quieted quickly. Fortunately for the Ravens, Flacco was cleared to play the opener. All was well in Baltimore. 12. There were no health issues for Alex Smith during the 2017 preseason, but his life did change in April. The Chiefs again had an excellent regular season in 2016, going 11-5 and winning the AFC West, edging the Oakland Raiders on the last day of the season thanks to having beaten them twice, giving them the tiebreaker when the two teams finished with identical records. That meant the Chiefs were the number two seed in the AFC behind the Patriots and got to play their first playoff game at home under Andy Reid. Unfortunately, the opponent was the Steelers, a team they always seemed to struggle with. This time was no different. The Steelers' defense shut down the Chiefs' offense for most of the day, and when the Chiefs finally scored late in the game to cut the margin to 18-16, the Steelers stopped the two-point conversion attempt and hung on to win. Smith had been in Kansas City for four seasons. The Chiefs had reached the playoffs on three of those occasions, but had not made it to a conference championship game. Smith was about to turn 33 and had 2 years left on his contract. "There's a window for players," he said, "just like there's a window for teams. I felt as if I was playing as well as I'd ever played, but I also know football's a business, and that coaches and general managers have to try to be one step ahead when it comes to personnel. If they're not, they become former coaches and general managers pretty quickly." Which is why Smith wasn't terribly surprised when he got a text from Andy Reid 2 days prior to the draft, letting him know that the Chiefs were planning to use a high draft pick on a quarterback. Who it would be and exactly when it would come, he didn't say. The point of the text was to let Smith know the Chiefs were beginning to think about life after Alex. "The quarterback room hadn't really changed much in terms of me being the leader for 4 years," Smith said. "They hadn't drafted anyone before the fifth round, and they had brought Nick, Foles, in specifically to be my backup. In the NFL, 4 years is a long time not to make any change in the QB room. It's so important to the team that you can't afford to get caught short." During Smith's four seasons playing for Reed, there had never been any doubt that the other quarterbacks in the room were his backups, there to play only if he got hurt. Reed's text didn't change that. Clearly, Smith was going to be the starter in 2017, but there were no guarantees beyond that. "What it did was make me aware that the window was starting to close," he said. "It didn't represent any sort of change of life for me at that moment. If they hadn't drafted someone, my future would have still depended on whether I played well or not. If I played well, I'd have a job. If I didn't play well, I wouldn't have a job. The only difference really was an understanding that if I played well, I'd still have a job, but there was no guarantee that it would be in Kansas City." Reed wasn't completely sure the Chiefs would get the chance to draft Patrick Mahomes, the quarterback they liked, but he felt Smith deserved a heads up. "I knew we liked the kid. and I knew there was a chance we were going to be able to get him, Reed said. I told Alex, you just keep being you. Don't look over your shoulder because there's no need to do that. I wasn't really worried about whether he could do that or not because he's got NFL scar tissue. I knew if we did it that he'd handle it well. As it turned out, the Chiefs decided to go all in on drafting a quarterback they believed would be Smith's successor. They had the 27th pick in the first round, but ended up trading with the Buffalo Bills to move to the 10th spot. To do that, they had to give up their first pick, their third pick, and their number one pick in the 2018 draft. That was a heavy price to pay to move up 17 spots, but they had decided to push all their chips in on Mahomes, who had left Texas Tech after his junior season. Mahomes was actually a little shorter than Smith, 6'2 to 6'4, and a little slower, 4.80 in the 40 at the combine compared to Smith's 4.67. He had a rifle for an arm, and perhaps most important, was 11 years younger than Smith. I'm realistic, Smith said after the season had started. You don't spend that much to get someone with the intention of sitting them on the bench for 2 years. But for the moment, I'm worried only about this season. If I play well, the future will take care of itself one way or the other. Colin Kaepernick had talked about how supportive Smith had been after he had taken over for him as the starter in San Francisco. This was different, but Smith was very comfortable being in a mentoring role for someone he knew had been anointed as his successor. I've heard about quarterbacks, Tom Brady among them, who don't want to share stuff with younger players, he said. I'm just not built that way. There's absolutely no reason for me not to help Patrick out in any way I can. When I was young, there were older guys who went out of their way to try to teach me. There's no reason why I can't do that, too. There are certain things you can tell someone, player to player, that's different from coach to player. When I first got to San Francisco, I had to go from spread and shotgun to taking snaps under center. The coaches were always on me about my footwork. I was always counting steps, 3 steps, 5 steps, 7. It got to the point where, at times, I wasn't even looking at the defense or at my receivers. Footwork, footwork, footwork. I think it's okay to work on those fundamentals in practice. But when you get in a game, that all has to go out the window. You can't think about that. The most important thing is your eyes. You have to see the game. Know who needs to be blocked. Know where the defense is. See your receivers. Read the defenders. That's all with your eyes. That's the kind of thing I tried to work with Patrick on. No one was more aware of Smith's mentoring of Mahomes than Reed. What he did for him, you can't pay back with money, he said. He helped him with things in ways that a coach simply can't do. There was complete trust from pupil to mentor. Knowing Alex, I wouldn't have expected anything different. It helped that Smith and Mahomes hit it off from the beginning. All three quarterbacks, Tyler Bray was in his fourth season as the Chiefs' number three quarterback, got along well. Smith and his wife, Elizabeth, often had Mahomes and his girlfriend and Bray and his wife over to their house for dinner during the week. It was a very comfortable dynamic in the room, Smith said. You can never underestimate how important that is because the three quarterbacks and the quarterback coach, in this case offensive coordinator Matt Nagy, spend a lot of time together. If you aren't comfortable with one another, that can be a problem. As is often the case with the too long preseason, the Chiefs took a couple of key hits. Playing in Seattle in Week 3, the game in which the starters get the most playing time, starting running back Spencer Ware caught a short pass from Smith and zigzagged his way inside the 10-yard line before suddenly going down. Just like Flacco with Pitta, Smith knew right away the injury was serious. When it's non-contact, when someone like Spence just goes down like that, you know it's bad, he said. My first thought was how unfair it was for him. Jamal, Charles, was gone, and the stage was all his. He'd played well the year before, and we all thought he was ready to be a star. Then this happens. Andy Reid felt the same way. Any injury like that is tough to deal with, no matter how often you've seen it happen, he said. But this was gut-wrenching. It wasn't that I didn't have confidence in our kid, rookie Kareem Hunt, but that Spencer deserved better than that. The NFL chews up running backs and spits them out. Charles had been one of the league's dominant running backs. He'd had 5 1,000-plus-yard seasons prior to a torn ACL in 2015 and had needed a second surgery in 2016 after playing in just 3 games. Ware, who had been released by the Seahawks once and waived by the Chiefs before being re-signed, stepped in and rushed for 921 yards on 214 carries and had caught 33 passes for another 447 yards. Even though Ware was carted off the field, the initial reports were that he had just sprained the knee. Smith suspected that further tests wouldn't be quite as encouraging. He was right. 2 days later, after the team had flown home from Seattle, Ware underwent an MRI that showed multiple torn ligaments in the knee. He was done for the season. All of a sudden, Kareem Hunt, who had played in the Mid-American Conference the previous fall at the University of Toledo, was the starting running back. Next man up, life in the NFL. The Chiefs were less than 2 weeks away from opening the NFL season in Foxborough against the Patriots, the Super Bowl champions. Smith had been thinking about that game since the NFL had unveiled its schedule, with all the bells and whistles you can possibly imagine, on April 20th. "You always start thinking about the first opponent when you see the schedule," he said, "but this was different. We were playing the very first game of the season. The entire league would be watching. We'd be playing a team that almost never loses at home, and we'd be walking into the stadium in the middle of their celebration of winning the Super Bowl. We all knew what the atmosphere would be like. It was the kind of challenge you have to crave if you're a competitor, no matter how difficult you think it may be." Now the Chiefs would be going into that crucible on Thursday night, September 7th, with a rookie drafted in the 3rd round at running back. "I think we all had a lot of confidence in Kareem," Smith said. "He'd shown us that he had plenty of talent in preseason. Of course, preseason is one thing. Playing in Foxborough against the Patriots is another." The game began almost exactly as most of America expected it to begin. The Patriots, as they always seem to do, took the opening kickoff and drove right down the field, 73 yards in 9 plays, and scored on a 2-yard run by rookie running back Mike Gillisley less than 3 minutes into the game, taking their usual 7-0 lead. On came the Chiefs' offense. On first down at the 25, Smith handed to Hunt, who bolted through a hole to pick up 7 quick yards. There was just one problem. He fumbled when hit, and the Patriots' Devin McCourty scooped up the fumble at the Chiefs' 32. Quickly, Brady got the Patriots to the Chiefs' 20 and found Rob Gronkowski in the end zone for a diving touchdown catch. The season was less than 5 minutes old, and the Chiefs, playing in arguably the toughest place in the NFL to win on the road, were down 14-0. "I was thinking, holy shit, we're down 14-0, and we've run one play on offense," Smith said. "One minute we're coming out of the tunnel pumped and ready and knowing we've got a really good plan, and the next minute we're down 14-0. Only they weren't. The touchdown pass was reviewed. This was the first test of the NFL's new rule by which all replay decisions came out of New York rather than ultimately being made by the referee. The play was overruled, correctly, as an incomplete pass. The score reverted to 7-0. 2 plays later, on 4th and inches from the 10, Belichick, as always, went for it, and the Chiefs' defense rose up and stuffed Gillisley for a half-yard loss. Just like that, the Chiefs had life. Smith promptly drove his team 90 yards in 12 plays, culminating with a 7-yard pass to Demetrius Harris. That tied the game at 7-7 and allowed the Chiefs to take a deep breath. Reed, offensive coordinator Matt Nagy, and Smith had believed coming into the game that they could move the ball on the Patriots' defense. Now they had tangible evidence that they were right. "Right there, the tone of the entire night changed," Smith said. "It went from people thinking blowout to shootout." It became a shootout. The Patriots led 17-7 late in the 2nd quarter when the Chiefs took over on their own 10 with 2:47 left. Mixing short passes with runs and using his timeouts deftly, Smith took the Chiefs down the field on their 2nd 90-yard drive of the night, this time climaxed by a 3-yard pass to Hunt with 13 seconds to go that made the halftime score 17-14. "That drive was so key," Smith said. "We'd fumbled on our first offensive play, had terrible field position the whole half, and got out of there down 3 with the ball coming to us to start the 2nd half. Plus, we hadn't used a lot of the stuff we thought would work against them. It was a very up locker room. It probably helped that the Chiefs were unaware that the Patriots had led at halftime 81 times in regular season games played in Gillette Stadium since it opened in 2002 and had won all 81. Except at the Super Bowl, with its endless overhyped show, halftime in the NFL is quick. It lasts a total of 13 minutes, which doesn't leave a lot of time for adjustments or rah-rah speeches. By halftime, you're usually too tired to give a rah-rah speech, even if you wanted to, Smith said. Most halftime routines are the same. Coach talks briefly to the team, then offensive coaches and defensive coaches go to separate rooms to discuss adjustments or changes, either in play calling or personnel. The medical staff updates the head coach on injuries. Then each unit meets briefly before the coach has a few final words before returning to the field. Reed, Nagy, and defensive coordinator Bob Sutton didn't think any major changes were needed. They wanted to run the ball a little more often since Hunt had run well and with confidence after his fumble. They were hoping to get more pressure on Brady because not doing so was always suicidal. On the second play of the second series of the second half, Smith looked deep and found the fleet Tyreek Hill behind the defense. He hit him in stride, and 75 yards later, the Chiefs had the lead, 21-17. The Patriots answered with a touchdown and a field goal and led 27-21 after three quarters. It looked like 82-0 with a halftime lead was inevitable. The Chiefs had played well and hung in, but as usual in Foxborough, it wasn't going to be enough. And then the fourth quarter happened. The defense finally got some pressure on Brady, and the offense kept him off the field most of the quarter. The Patriots had two series and went three and out on both of them. Meanwhile, the Chiefs kept pounding at a tiring Patriots defense. Hunt was slashing and breaking tackles all over the field. He would finish the night with 239 yards in total offense, the most ever by a rookie running back in his first game since the AFL and NFL had merged in 1970. The running game opened up the passing game for Smith. The Chiefs took the lead 28-27 on the second play of the quarter on a 78-yard Smith to Hunt pass. Then, with 5:14 to go, Hunt scored again on a 4-yard run to make it 35-27. The Patriots, needing a touchdown and 2-point conversion to tie, meekly went three and out. It took all of two plays, a 58-yard Hunt run and a 21-yard touchdown run by backup Charkhandrick West to up the lead to a stunning 42-27. Game over. The Chiefs had outscored the Patriots 21-0 in the fourth quarter to win by that 42-27 margin. The result stunned the sellout crowd, the Patriots, and the entire league. One of the most oft-asked questions in preseason had been, can the Patriots go 19-0? Answer, no, emphatically. It was amazing to contrast the end of the game from the beginning of the game, Smith said, smiling at the memory. We came out there and the place was still going crazy from their trophy ceremony and all the speeches. Then they go right down the field and score and we fumble. Loud beyond belief. Then in the fourth quarter, I watched as people went up the aisles to get to the parking lot in complete silence. The place was like a tomb, except on our sideline. It was amazing. Smith had outplayed Brady, throwing for 4 touchdowns and 368 yards. No quarterback had ever thrown for 4 touchdowns without an interception against a Bill Belichick defense. In 17 seasons under Belichick, the Patriots had never given up 42 points. It was quite a start to what the Chiefs all believed might be a special season. There was one down note. Late in the fourth quarter, Eric Berry, the Chiefs' all-pro safety, went down with what turned out to be a ruptured Achilles tendon, meaning his season was over after one game. Berry was more than just an excellent safety. He was the leader of the Chiefs' defense, someone who had survived cancer to come back and be an all-pro for the third time in his career in 2016. Very hard to take seeing Eric go off on a cart, Smith said. It sounds like a broken record sometimes when you talk about how hard it is to see your teammates get hurt, but it is. That was especially true with Eric because of all he's been through and because he's so important to us emotionally. It took a little edge off the night. The good news was that the Chiefs had pulled off something almost no one had expected. They had a head start on the rest of the league with a 1-0 record, and they had 10 days off to prepare for their home opener against the Philadelphia Eagles. Most people didn't know at that point just how good the Eagles were. Smith had a pretty good idea, but he would have an even better idea once the game was over. 13. It had taken Ryan Fitzpatrick a while to recover from his lost 2016 season in New Jersey. Even after 12 years in the NFL, even though he understood blame for losing always started with the quarterback, the 180-degree change in fortune was stunning to him. "Intellectually, I understood it," he said. "In this case, it wasn't just being the quarterback. It was also about being in New York. Everything there is exaggerated. When you play well, you're not just a hero, you're a superhero. When you don't play well, you aren't just a goat, you're whatever is beyond being a goat. It wore me down. By the end of any season, if you've been playing, you aren't just worn out physically, you're worn out emotionally. You have to put so much into every game. This time was different. This time I wasn't sure if I wanted to play again, even if I had an opportunity to play." After a few weeks at home with his family, with the physical and emotional pounding of the season behind him, he began to relax, a little. "Actually, I got to a place where my approach was, let's see what happens," he said, as in, let's see if anyone comes looking for me with some kind of an offer. He knew, realistically, he was again part of the backup market. There would be no $12 million deals on the table. That was okay, though, because money wasn't the question. He'd already made millions more than he'd ever dreamed of making coming out of Harvard. Chances were good, he knew, that he was the highest paid member of Harvard's class of 2005, and that was probably saying something. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg would have been class of 06 had he graduated. The question then was twofold. Did he want to go play again? And just as important, was he ready to subject his family to yet another move? "We liked it in New Jersey," he said. "We lived about 10 minutes from the facility, and the kids liked their schools. But by then, Liza had become such a pro at moving that neither one of us saw that as a big issue." A short time later, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers came looking for someone to back up Jameis Winston. Mike Glennon, who had been the Bucs' third-round draft pick in 2013, had left Tampa Bay to sign a stunning three-year $45 million deal with the Chicago Bears. The Bucs were looking for a veteran who could counsel the sometimes immature Winston and also be ready to step in and keep the team competitive if Winston got hurt. The offer was 1 year, $3 million. This was in May, 2 months after the free agent window had opened. With Glennon gone, the only other quarterback on the Bucs roster behind Winston was Ryan Griffin, who had been the team's third-string quarterback for 2 years and had never taken a snap in an NFL game. When the team didn't find anyone in the middle rounds of the draft to their liking at quarterback, they began looking for an unsigned free agent who wasn't going to be controversial. Colin Kaepernick had plenty of game experience and wasn't going to be too expensive. Fitzpatrick checked all the boxes. "By May, I felt like I wanted to play," he said. "If no one made an offer, I was at peace with it. I'd played 12 years. I'd had a lot more success than I'd ever dreamed. I still remember when I went past 25,000 yards passing in my career, my dad calling me and saying, 'I can't believe you've passed for more than 25,000 yards. I wasn't that far behind my boyhood hero, Jake Plummer, 29,253. At that point, the number was kind of mind-boggling to me. But when the Bucs came along, I saw it as an opportunity. Liza encouraged me, too. She's an athlete, and she reminded me I'd be an ex-NFL player for a long time. Why not continue to be one for as long as possible? So I jumped back in with no doubts." Once again, Liza handled the move. Some things went back to Arizona or into storage. The rest of it went to a new house in Tampa. The kids had to be registered for school and signed up for sports. Ryan was free to focus on learning another offensive system and on adjusting, again, to being a backup. He liked Winston right away and could see his potential up close after a few snaps in practice. The Bucs had gone 9-7 in 2016, only the 12th winning season in the 41 years of the franchise's existence and their first since 2010. and they went into 2017 with high hopes. Many of those hopes were built around Winston, who had won the Heisman Trophy in 2013 and had been the number one pick in the NFL draft in 2015. His life had not been without controversy. There had been a sexual assault allegation, a shoplifting incident, a profane sexist meme shouted from the top of a table in the Florida State Student Union, and very little genuine regret from Winston in the wake of any of the incidents. He was, in many ways, typical of the coddled athlete who is told by those around him that he is never wrong. Fitzpatrick viewed Winston with a clean slate. Winston was friendly, outgoing, and bright. He was willing to listen when Fitzpatrick brought some of his old man wisdom to the table. Jameis still has some learning to do, like a lot of young quarterbacks, Fitzpatrick said early in the season. People tend to forget he's only 23 and he's been in the public eye for a long time. He's a talker. He is never brief on any subject. One of the things he's getting better at is listening. He doesn't have anything against it. He just has to be reminded every now and then to do it. One thing about the Bucs training camp was different from any other camp Fitzpatrick had been in: the presence of Hard Knocks. The HBO series had started in 2001 and was a joint venture between the network and the NFL. Each summer, it chronicled one team's training camp, from the arrival of the rookies through the final cuts. It ran for four consecutive weeks once the first exhibition games began. HBO had complete access to everything and everyone in the camp, although the NFL, through NFL Films, had the ability to censor anything that might be embarrassing for a team, a player, or the league. There would be no discussion of Colin Kaepernick, for example, on Hard Knocks. The star of the 2017 version of Hard Knocks from beginning to end was Winston. The series has become formulaic in recent years. The producers pick a couple of star players to focus on and a couple of players on the bubble to make the team. They also focus on the coach and the general manager. When the series began, the scenes in which a coach and or GM told a player he was cut were dramatic. Now they feel staged. Every player has done a great job, worked hard, is a great guy, and will no doubt get another chance. Every player is grateful for the chance he's been given, and everyone hugs when it's all over. It's become a reality show. In other words, very little of it is real. Since Fitzpatrick lockered next to Winston, he was often on camera while Winston talked, whether to the camera or to teammates. Fitzpatrick had his moments in the spotlight. He had started a preseason tradition years earlier, requiring the starting quarterback for each exhibition game to come up with a poem that all the quarterbacks, usually four during preseason, would recite before taking the field. Although HBO never credited him with the idea, it did show the recitation of the poem each week. He had brief on-camera moments throughout the series, but the producers were a lot more interested in Winston's burgeoning stardom than with the story of a seventh-round draft pick from Harvard playing for his seventh team. Fitzpatrick was fine with that. "I had no problem with them being around," he said. "I think we all kind of enjoyed it. But Jameis was the star, as he should be, and I wasn't one of those guys whose career hung in the balance. I was going to be the backup quarterback unless Jameis got hurt or I got hurt. There wasn't that much of a storyline there." Training camp passed without incident. Hard Knocks, which at times in the past had made news, made none. The Bucs were scheduled to open the season in Miami, but that didn't happen. With the massive Hurricane Irma headed for South Florida, the NFL made the sensible decision to postpone the game. Both teams had their byes in Week 11, so the game was rescheduled for then. That meant the two teams would have to play 16 straight weeks beginning in Week 2 of the season, but there really wasn't any choice. And so the Bucs opened their season at home against the Chicago Bears. Chicago, which would finish the season 5-11 and fire coach John Fox, proved to be the perfect opening game opponent. Glennon, whose $45 million contract had become even more baffling when the Bears used the number 2 pick in the draft to take Mitchell Trubisky, was still the starter. He threw two interceptions and fumbled once. In all, the Bears had four turnovers and the Bucs led 29-0 before Chicago scored a late consolation touchdown to make the final 29-7. Winston was 18 of 30 for 201 yards, all he needed since the Bucs scored most of their points on short field drives after turnovers. Their first touchdown of the season came on a one-play 13-yard drive, Winston finding wide receiver Mike Evans for the score. Fitzpatrick came in to mop up on the final two series of the game, throwing one incomplete pass and then ending the game with two kneel downs. It certainly wasn't the same feeling you have when you're the starter, or even when you come into a game suddenly after an injury, he said. But it was nice to be part of a win and to get back on the field in a real game, even if the game was decided. In a perfect world, every game would be like that, but I knew that wouldn't be the case. It's always a long season in the NFL. Neither Fitzpatrick nor Winston nor the rest of the Bucks had any idea just how long this one would be. Joe Flacco hadn't taken a single snap during the exhibition season. He knew he would be a little bit rusty going into the Ravens opener in Cincinnati, but he wasn't that concerned about it. He'd felt good in practice the week prior to the game and was looking forward to getting back on the field. I've been in the league long enough now that playing in exhibition games isn't that big a deal one way or the other, he said. If I'd been completely healthy, I might have two or three quarters for max. I really didn't look at it as a big deal. It turned out not to be a big deal at all, thanks to the performance of the Bengals' Andy Dalton and the Ravens' defense. Dalton threw four interceptions, and the Bengals had five turnovers in all. Flacco threw only 12 passes, completing nine of them. One was a 49-yard second-quarter touchdown pass to Jeremy Maclin, who had been picked up in June after the Chiefs had released him for salary cap reasons. That pass climaxed the only sustained touchdown drive of the game. The Ravens got another touchdown later in the quarter after Lardarius Webb returned one of the Dalton interceptions to the Cincinnati 2-yard line. It was 17-0 at halftime, and the Ravens cruised to a 20-0 victory. A week later, the Ravens opened at home against the hapless Browns. For a lot of the game, Cleveland didn't look hapless, keeping the game competitive for much of the afternoon. The Browns, who would become the second team in NFL history, 2008 Lions, to go 0-16, split time during the game between quarterbacks DeShone Kizer, a rookie from Notre Dame, and Kevin Hogan, a second-year player from Stanford, who had been cut by the Chiefs. Neither was exactly a Pro Bowl candidate, and yet at times each moved the ball against the Ravens' defense. Their undoing, not surprisingly, was turnovers, five in all, meaning the Ravens had turned their opponents over 10 times in two games. The Ravens led throughout, scoring the first two touchdowns of the game, but the margin was only 21-10 after three quarters. Flacco was solid, completing 25 of 34 passes. He threw two touchdown passes and an interception, the latter coming when he threw the ball up for grabs on third and long, and defensive back Jason McCourty intercepted it at the Cleveland 9-yard line. It was the equivalent of a good punt. No real damage done. The Ravens were never in serious danger of losing. A Justin Tucker field goal early in the fourth quarter extended the margin to 24-10, but the Ravens couldn't get the Cleveland offense off the field in the final minutes, allowing a 12-play, 57-yard drive they finally stopped on downs in the final minute. It wasn't pretty, Flacco said afterward, but it really doesn't matter how you win as long as you win. That's what he told the media in his post-game press conference. Flacco, like any experienced quarterback, knows what to say and what not to say. He took responsibility for the interception, saying he shouldn't have just thrown the ball, hoping one of his guys would grab it. He didn't bring up the fact that he had very little time to throw and very little to lose by attempting the pass. If a receiver drops the ball, you shrug and say, maybe you could have let him a little more. If the O-line isn't giving you enough time to throw, it's still on you to get the ball out quick enough. Flacco knew there was some fool's gold in the first two wins. Neither the Bengals nor the Browns were very good. The Browns, in fact, were awful. The Ravens' defense wasn't going to continue to average five turnovers a game. The running game was still suspect, and perhaps most important, the team's best offensive lineman, right guard Marshall Yanda, had gone down in the second quarter, when Cleveland defensive lineman Danny Shelton rolled up on his right ankle. When Yanda didn't get up, the trainers and doctors came out to check on him. Standing nearby, Flacco knew right away it was serious, just as he had known in June that the injury to Pitta was serious. It was the look on his face, Flacco said. He was in a lot of pain. Marshall is about as tough as it gets. He played most of last season, 2016, with one arm after he hurt his shoulder and was still one of the best linemen in the league. Flacco wasn't exaggerating. One website had selected Yanda as the best lineman in the league, and he had made the Pro Bowl for the sixth straight time. The Ravens were already thin on the offensive line. Center John Urschel had stunned the team by suddenly retiring on the first day of training camp in late July. Urschel wasn't exactly your typical football player. He was only 26 and had been spending his off seasons working toward a PhD in math at MIT. He had missed 3 weeks in preseason with a concussion a year earlier, and had later said that the concussion had affected his ability to make sense of some of the math problems he was working on. He retired 2 days after a new study had been published showing that CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, had shown up in 99% of the brains that had been donated by ex-football players after their death. Urschel never publicly discussed whether the new CTE study affected his decision, saying only that he was looking forward to pursuing his studies at MIT on a full-time basis. But inside the locker room, the sense was that he had been shaken, like many players were, by the latest study. The NFL had done everything it possibly could to downplay the effects of concussions in playing football on the minds and bodies of its players. It had dismissed the initial discovery of CTE by Dr. Bennett Amalu and had acknowledged it only after the evidence had become overwhelming and after CTE had shown up in the brains of a number of well-known players, notably Hall of Fame linebacker Junior Seau and Pro Bowl safety Dave Duerson. Both committed suicide by shooting themselves in the chest while leaving behind notes for their families asking that their brains be studied for CTE. Both were found to have suffered from the disease. When Seau was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2015, the Hall, which is technically run by an independent group but is almost solely funded by the NFL, refused to allow his daughter Sydney to give his induction speech, even though Seau had specifically said prior to his death that if he was voted into the Hall, he wanted her to speak in his place. Under tremendous public pressure, including from a number of Hall of Famers, the Hall finally agreed to a 5-minute onstage interview with Sydney, during which there was no mention of Seau's death or CTE. The Hall's blowhard director, David Baker, defended the decision by saying that induction into the Hall was about a player's career, not his life. Except that most Hall of Fame speeches practically drown in discussions of what a great man the player was, not just his playing career. 2 weeks after Urschel retired, starting left guard Alex Lewis also went down for the season, requiring surgery on his left shoulder. Yanda's injury meant the Ravens were now down 3 starters, including their best upfront player. Tony Bergstrom, who had been acquired from Arizona just prior to the start of the season to provide depth, suddenly was the starting right guard. "You have to deal with injuries. It's simple as that," Flacco said. "Every team has players get hurt. But some guys are harder to replace than others. Marshall was going to be very hard to replace, especially on a young line that was trying to gel. Winning tends to overshadow problems. The Ravens were 2-0. And for some, the preseason doubts had quickly become a thing of the past. Game 3 would be in London, against a Jacksonville team that had gone 3-13 the previous season. There was good reason to believe the Ravens would be 3-0 when the Steelers came to town the following week for the first of their 2 meetings. The Jaguars had opened with an easy win in Houston, against a Texans team that for some reason was quarterbacked by Tom Savage, even though the team had drafted Deshaun Watson with the 12th pick in the draft to be the team's quarterback of the future. Once upon a time, it was a given in the NFL that rookie quarterbacks would spend the season holding a clipboard and learning their craft by watching. As recently as 2003, there were still teams doing that. Carson Palmer, taken with the first pick by the Bengals in the 2003 draft, never took a snap that season. Instead, the immortal John Kitna was the quarterback. But that had become the exception. Both Troy Aikman and Peyton Manning had been thrown into the fire right away as rookies on bad teams, the 1-15 Dallas Cowboys in 1989 and the 3-13 Indianapolis Colts in 1998. Flacco had also started Game 1, but probably would not have done so if Troy Smith hadn't gotten sick during the preseason. Andrew Luck and Alex Smith, each the number one pick in the draft, had started from the beginning, although Smith had been in and out as a starter in 2005. The Bears had started Mike Glennon over Mitchell Trubisky at the start of the 2017 season, if only to justify the $45 million they had spent on him. By game four, Trubisky was the starter. Bill O'Brien had done the same with Watson, going with Savage, a proven mediocrity, over Watson to start the season. O'Brien cited Savage's experience as the reason for going with him to start the season. Savage had started two games in 2016. It's no secret that NFL coaches, Bill Belichick being the most notable exception, almost always choose the conservative route, because any out-of-the-box thinking that fails is going to cause media and fan outrage. That's why they almost always punt on fourth and less than a yard, even though the odds are in their favor if they go for it. Fail once and all sorts of criticism will come down on their head. Belichick, with five Super Bowl rings, is immune to criticism. Most coaches see it as kryptonite. It took exactly one half and a 19-0 deficit for O'Brien to realize that Savage could have 50 years of experience, and he still wasn't going to be a very good NFL quarterback. Watson replaced him at halftime, but it was too late, and the Jaguars won 29-7. These weren't the Jaguars of the recent past. They had become a solid team, especially on defense, as the Ravens would find out a short time later in London. The Ravens flew to London on Thursday prior to the game. They practiced Friday, and then everyone tried to catch up on sleep and get acclimated to the 5-hour time difference on Friday night. They awoke Saturday to find that the NFL world they had been living in before they went to bed had changed considerably. On Friday night, President Donald Trump had spoken at a rally for Luther Strange, who had been appointed to the Senate seat vacated by Jeff Sessions when Trump made him Attorney General. Strange was running in a special election primary the following Tuesday, and Trump was speaking on his behalf. Knowing his audience, decidedly right-wing, Trump decided to attack NFL players who had not been standing for the national anthem. "Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, 'Get that son of a bitch off the field right now. He's fired. He's fired,'" Trump said. "You know, some owner is going to do that. He's going to say, 'That guy disrespects our flag. He's fired.' And that owner, they don't know it, but they'll be the most popular person in the country." Trump, who once owned a team in the United States Football League, a league that failed miserably in an attempt to challenge the NFL, both on the field and in court, then attacked the entire league. "The NFL ratings are down massively. Now, the number one reason happens to be they don't like watching what's happening. Because, you know, today, if you hit too hard, 15 yards. Throw them out of the game. They're ruining the game. That's what they want to do. They want to hit. They want to hit. It's hurting the game. But do you know what's hurting the game more than that? When people like yourselves turn on the television and you see these people taking the knee when they're playing our great national anthem. The only thing you could do better is, if you see it, even if it's one player, leave the stadium. I guarantee things will stop. Just pick up and leave. Pick up and leave. Not the same game anymore anyway." Trump's rant instantly did what he does best, divided the country. Clearly, he saw the players in much the same way the Romans saw the gladiators once upon a time. Whether they lived or died, of CTE rather than the sword, didn't matter as long as he and his fellow Romans were entertained. How dare they protest in any way about racial injustice? They should just shut their mouths and go out and blast one another into next weekend. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who was in London for the Ravens-Jaguars game, labeled the president's comments divisive. Many players took to Twitter to attack Trump. The irony was that the anthem protests that Colin Kaepernick had started a year earlier had slowed to a trickle once the season started. As soon as Trump's comments went viral, it was apparent that many players were going to feel compelled to respond. In London, there was no formal discussion among the Ravens players, but it did come up in the locker room. "The general consensus was that we didn't need a consensus," Flacco said. "I think everyone wanted to make sure that no one felt pressured to do one thing or another. If guys wanted to kneel, that was fine. If guys didn't want to kneel, that was fine too. There was no arguing, no one saying this way is right. There was just an understanding that each of us had to do what we felt was right for us. Like most teams that Sunday, the Ravens fell into two groups. One group, which included Coach John Harbaugh, locked arms in a show of unity while the anthem was played. Flacco was in that group. The other group knelt together, arms locked. There were 10 Ravens who knelt, as did Ray Lewis, the retired Hall of Fame linebacker who knelt with the players in uniform. On the other sideline, Jaguars owner Shad Khan, who had given money to Trump, locked arms with his players who were standing. A dozen Jaguars knelt. All the players on both sidelines then stood for the playing of God Save the Queen, the British national anthem. Because the game was the first one played that Sunday, kicking off at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and because it was played in a foreign country, it received a great deal of attention. Some right-wing pundits were outraged that players would kneel for the Star-Spangled Banner and then stand for God Save the Queen. "It's embarrassing that they show respect for another country's anthem, but not for their own," screeched one Fox News anchor. Another yelped that it was disgusting that players making hundreds of millions of dollars would stage such a protest. "I'd like to know," she demanded, "what are they protesting? What exactly are they protesting?" Apparently working for Fox News doesn't require knowing anything about the news. The Ravens-Jaguars game was just the beginning of a day filled with protests. Three teams, the Tennessee Titans and Seattle Seahawks, who were playing each other in Nashville, and the Pittsburgh Steelers, who were playing in Chicago, stayed in the locker room during the playing of the anthem, violating normal NFL protocol. 32 members of the Denver Broncos and 20 members of the Cleveland Browns knelt. Many owners followed Khan's example and locked arms with standing players during the anthem, including Washington's Dan Snyder, another major Trump contributor and supporter. Seven of Snyder's players chose to kneel, and on the opposite sideline, more than half of the Oakland Raiders knelt or sat. Ravens owner Steve Bisciotti, also a Republican, issued a statement that said, quote, "We recognize our players' influence and support them 100%. All voices need to be heard. That's democracy in its highest form," unquote. In Los Angeles, Alex Smith was truly torn by what was going on. Prior to Trump's rant, only one Chiefs player, cornerback Marcus Peters, had knelt during the anthem. Most of the players who had protested in the past had been African Americans. Most of those who had knelt throughout the day were also African American, with a handful of exceptions. In spite of Trump's claims that this is not a racial issue, it was clearly a racial issue. Kaepernick had started his protest in response to what he believed was white police brutality directed at African Americans. Smith understood this and felt for his African American teammates. "They were in a no-win situation," he said. "If they knelt for the anthem, they would be viewed by many people as betraying their country in some way. But if they didn't kneel, didn't protest in some way, they would be viewed by many in their race as betraying them. It was a terribly unfair position for them to be put in." Chiefs coach Andy Reid had taken the same approach as the Ravens' John Harbaugh. What the players did was up to them. They wouldn't be judged, regardless of what they did during the anthem. The players knew that was true of Reid, but weren't so sure how true it would be when it came to the team's chairman, Clark Hunt, who had inherited the team from his father, Lamar Hunt. Clark Hunt had been one of the more outspoken owners on the subject of anthem protests in the past. Now, though, his public stance softened. "We believe in honoring the American flag and supporting all of those whose sacrifices protect the many freedoms we have in this country, including the right to have differences of opinion," he said in a statement that day. The last eight words were different from what Hunt had said in the past, when he had made it clear he expected his players to stand for the anthem after Peters had stopped doing so. Smith wasn't going to kneel for the anthem, but he and Patrick Mahomes stood behind the bench rather than just off the field, the traditional place where players lined up during the anthem. By the time the day was over, more than 200 players had knelt or sat during the anthem, and that didn't include the players on the three teams who stayed in the locker room. The week prior to Trump's comments, a total of six players had failed to stand for the anthem. Alejandro Villanueva, the Steelers' starting left tackle, who had been an Army Ranger and served three tours in Afghanistan, accidentally became a hero of the right when he stood just outside the tunnel during the playing of the anthem. Villanueva said later he had planned to join his teammates in the locker room because it had been decided they would all do the same thing, but got caught short of the tunnel when the anthem began. Out of respect for other veterans and those who have been wounded overseas, I had to stop, he said. I feel like I threw my teammates under the bus. His teammates didn't see it that way and understood what had happened. Asked to comment on Trump's comments, Villanueva said he had no comment one way or the other. Many of his fellow players made their feelings crystal clear with their actions. Joe Flacco was relieved once the anthems had been played in London because once the game started, the political turmoil would fade to black, at least for a few hours. Unfortunately, the game brought very little relief. The Jaguars were in complete control right from the start. The Ravens' initial first down of the day came with 4:18 to play before halftime. By then, their first five possessions had produced 4 3-and-outs and a Flacco interception caused by Jeremy Maclin being separated from the ball and his senses as he went over the middle, with Jacksonville's A.J. Bouye ending up with the football. The Jaguars, who were publicly doing a Hamlet routine about whether Blake Bortles, who had been the number 3 pick in the draft in 2014, was good enough to be their quarterback long-term, scored on 5 of their first 6 possessions. Field goal, touchdown, field goal, touchdown, field goal. It was 23-0 at halftime. There's really not much for anyone to say in a situation like that, Flacco said. I'm the offensive captain. But if I get up and give a rah-rah speech, it isn't going to do much good. As poorly as we'd played, believe it or not, we weren't thinking the game was over. Our attitude was, had to be, if they can score 23.5, we can too. We'd scored that many, more in fact, in the past. So why not go out and do it again? You can't hang your head at that point. If you do, things are only going to get worse. They certainly didn't get any better. Flacco was surprised when offensive coordinator Marty Morningweg, who had taken over in October of the previous season when Mark Trestman had been fired, told the players that they would be running their regular offense in the second half. I thought, given the score, that we might go 2-minute right away, Flacco said. We needed to speed up the game, and given that we'd done nothing on offense the first half, I didn't think we had anything to lose by going 2-minute. In the end, it didn't really matter. The Ravens could have come out in the old Texas wishbone, and it probably wouldn't have changed anything. The second half went much like the first, and Jacksonville heaped on more points. The final shellacking of 44-7 was every bit as humiliating as it appeared to be. The good news was that the Ravens' arch-rival, the Steelers, were coming to Baltimore the following Sunday. Seriously, that is good news, Flacco said 2 days after the game, tucked into a corner of the Ravens team dining room. If the Steelers coming to town can't get our minds moving forward and off of what happened Sunday, nothing can. 14. Doug Williams had been named Washington's Senior Vice President for Player Personnel in June. Depending on your point of view, that position could mean 3 things. He was either the team's general manager, but without the title, or the chief scout, or a figurehead, given the position because owner Dan Snyder and team president Bruce Allen were desperate to do something that would create goodwill among their fans and the local media. There was no one better to do that than Williams. He was, after all, a Super Bowl hero, the MVP of Super Bowl XXII, the second of Joe Gibbs's 3 championships in Washington. He was respected in football and in the D.C. area, both as a person and as someone who knew the game. And unlike former general manager Scott McLuhan, he wasn't likely to clash publicly with Snyder or Allen. It just wasn't his way. So in a very real sense, Williams's new position was all of the above. He had the kind of scouting and personnel background that would make his voice a respected one in Washington's war room. He knew the team scouts well, having been on the staff for 3 years, and he could be a respected public face for a franchise whose owner and president were about as popular and respected as deposed Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling, who had been run out of the NBA. Williams hadn't had final say in the Washington draft room 2 months earlier, in April 2017, but he played a major role in what had been considered a very solid draft, especially after the chaotic ending to McLuhan's run in Washington, which had been filled with animosity, rumors, and all sorts of lying by the team and by McLuhan. It was clear by the end of the 2016 season